Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Let me remind you that we are Zooming on Wednesday morning, so you know the drill. We've now begun our show with some political verse by Skip Tenzer. So as I've always said, as Calvin Trillin is to the nation, eat your heart out, we have Skip. So now, hit it with the music, Dave.
Istanbul was Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, and Constantinople, been a long time gone. Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night.
He needs to take space up in your mind by any aggressive method he can find. Despite losing the vote, denial he promotes, like a horrible ex who won't leave you behind.
People just liked it better that way.
So take me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, why did Constantinople get the work?
And now we begin with our first guest of The Attitude for the Thursday edition. You know where I go all the time. I mind theconversation.com probably more than any talk show host in America. In part because I'm very grateful for what The Conversation does. It takes these brilliant minds, these PhDs, these professors, and they encourage them to write something that's actually readable. That's, you know, 1,000 to 2,000 words. You can actually sort of get through it, but it also takes their level of expertise and puts it into the vernacular. And as a result, I have been able to meet some of the most remarkable human beings on the planet from all over the country that I never would have had an occasion to meet. I'm a New Yorker, and I saw this piece and I went, I think we need to talk. Here is the title of the piece at theconversation.com. New Yorkers knew Donald Trump first, and they spurned him before many American voters did. Let me introduce you to our guest. He is the writer of this fabulous piece at The Conversation. Lincoln Mitchell is a political analyst, pundit, and writer based in New York City and San Francisco. He works on democracy and governments-related issues in the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, the Caribbean, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. I want his job. He also works with businesses and NGOs and does a lot of commentary probably across the media landscape. And we are lucky enough to say he actually now does commentary, at least for today, on The Attitude. So let me welcome Lincoln to the program. How are you, Lincoln?
Great. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
I read you my limerick for today, The Political Verse by Skip. The reason I picked it was because in part it sort of made me think of you as he was sending me this limerick. Because there is no question in my mind that Donald Trump is like a horrible ex who won't leave you behind. Having a horrible ex myself, I kind of related to this conversation. I mentioned that to you, and you said to me, actually, Arnie, that's very familiar because I did a piece for CNN about that. So before we wade into theconversation.com and New York's experience with Donald Trump, tell me a little bit about that CNN piece, because I really want to connect my political limericks to the conversations we have on this show.
What I said in the CNN piece is that much, this was before the election, that much of America has moved on from Donald Trump. So it doesn't matter what he says, what his campaign ads say, what he does in the rallies, because we're not listening. And I described him as, for many Americans, he's that ex whose calls we just let go directly to voicemail. Right. And I suggest we continue to do that in his post-presidency.
You wrote that before the election. Numbers that voted for Donald Trump terrify you? Because
yes.
It terrified me. For them, they haven't tuned him out. They still listen to every word. There's no question that they have, quote unquote, drunk the Kool-Aid. No matter what he says, they embrace. What I'm kind of curious about, as you go back to that piece you wrote for CNN, I do think there is a way for them to begin to tune him out. I think that what I describe Donald Trump as is that death becomes him. As we are seeing the spiking numbers of COVID in places like North Dakota and South Dakota and Iowa and all those places that embraced Donald Trump, rejected the science, thought it was an urban New Yorker problem or a Detroit problem, suddenly are realizing that they are not only dying and falling like flies, but they don't even have the healthcare system to address it. Do you think that the tune out now will not be because some of us have moved on, but because death has sort of slapped them around?
Before I answer that, you used the phrase drink the Kool-Aid. And I want to touch on that because I actually wrote a book that was quite a bit about that event. It wasn't Kool-Aid, it was Flavor-Aid. First of all, which was cheaper than Kool-Aid. And the People's Temple was in my hometown. I grew up in San Francisco. I was born in New York, grew up there. The massacre occurred 42 years ago today.
Are you kidding me?
I am not. And I raise that because, one, if you want to understand Donald Trump, you got to understand people like Jim Jones, unfortunately, and their followers. But also, not for nothing, you talk about it being a New York problem or Detroit problem. The city that handled it best in America was the city that the right likes to laugh at and ridicule, which is San Francisco. San Francisco has a fraction of the COVID deaths of South Dakota and has more people. So that just some political context. But you know, for the majority of Americans who did vote against this guy, we don't have to listen to his tweets anymore, right? If you work in the media political sphere, he may run again in 2024. There's a lot of things he's got to do between now and then to get there in a serious way. It is clear he is going to try to keep in, I don't want to say dialogue because that elevates it too much. I don't know what the word for a Twitter dialogue is, but he's going to try to keep in contact with that base. As the limerick in the beginning of the show noted, or phrased it more poetically than I'm going to, Trump craves attention more than anything else, more than oxygen, more than sex, more than well-done steak with ketchup, right? He has to have that attention, and he will do anything to keep having it. Now, the question is, in those places in rural America with this COVID, it's just devastating. Some percentage of the people will peel away from him, but not, I don't think, a majority, but some will. Now a major political question is, in the state of Georgia, where COVID is hitting hard, will enough people think differently of Trump, COVID, and his party by January 5th when those runoff elections are going to happen? We don't know the answer to that question yet.
This is horrible, but the pandemic is the window for the Georgia senators. If anything will deflate turnout, it will be the pandemic, and it will deflate turnout, I think, for Republicans more than Democrats, because Democrats really do see this as a solution to the kind of bad governance that we've been living under for the last 4 years. It sees it as a solution to really responding more nimbly, not to the pandemic, because I think Joe Biden will respond nimbly to the pandemic, but respond nimbly to a cratering economy and a healthcare system that's going to be incredibly devastated for at least a couple of years going forward. So in an interesting way, not only has his inability to respond to the pandemic been hurtful to him, but his denial of these elections isn't helpful either. The fact that the Republicans are eating their young in Georgia, I want to sit back and make popcorn because I can't believe I'm watching this. It is so interesting because he does crave attention. I'm going to share something with you, Lincoln. My background is in commercial talk radio. Okay. I actually have never done public radio. I mean, I've been a commentator on occasion, but I'm a little too lefty sometimes for them. But I've always been on commercial radio. In fact, at one point, I replaced Rush Limbaugh on 5 stations when his contract was taken away from the original 50 stations that had him. Everybody was like, is that owner nuts? He said, no, Arnie will not lose audience share. I didn't. Because in a lot of ways, I'm feisty, I'm interesting, I'm entertaining, but at the same time, I'm giving them facts. You know, I'm not making crap up. What is amazing to me is that that's kind of what people crave. My question then becomes, because he's now begun to alienate Fox, because I think there is some competition even for the Rush, I mean, eventually Rush isn't going to live in perpetuity. Does he actually maintain a relationship with his base? What does he have to offer them? Other than what he was, but not what he is.
Well, I think what he has to offer them, what you could see Donald Trump doing. Now, there's a lot of part components to that. One is substantively, what does he have to offer them? He will leave the office of presidency. I don't want to say the job because that suggests work. He will leave the office of the presidency and move from being kind of the commander in chief to the kibitzer in chief, which is a role with which he's more comfortable anyway. So you could see waking up in the morning, you know, in March of next year or something like that. And immediately, here's 5 tweets from Donald Trump attacking Joe Biden, right? Now, that's not going to resonate with the majority of the American people. It will resonate with his base. If he can keep, you know, those tens of millions of Twitter followers, if he his name recognition is going to be effectively 100 until the day he dies, if he can keep, even if it's only 30% of the people who like him, that's enough to be an extremely disruptive force, especially when you could easily imagine him saying every day, I'm the real president, I won this election. Now, does he go from there? I mean, some of these stories about he's going to build Trump television or this or that, I'm not sure I believe that. One, someone's got to pay for that, right? So he's got to get at least one billionaire to fund it or a collection of millionaires. And, you know, the Sheldon Adelsons of the world, he can't do anything for them anymore.
Exactly.
And most smart people, even on the right, understand he's not actually going to be president again. So why bother? So he's got to get the money. But even if he gets the money, he's got to do the work, right? So then the question is, if you are, I don't know, some Sinclair Radio or something, do you give him an hour talk show twice a week? Which I think financially he would probably get the ratings. He is, you know, it's talk radio. I think he could do that. But I don't think he has the ability to kind of get to the studio or have the studio come to him to sit in the chair. And, you know, those rallies, which, by the way, can I just say this? I'm old enough to remember reasonably well the day Richard Nixon resigned, right? I was a child. I remember my grandparents, I was staying with them at the time, bursting into cheers and clapping and celebrating downstairs when they heard the news on the evening news, which is how we got news back then. But I've been following presidents since, say, Carter, really. Presidents of the United States don't have mass rallies throughout their presidency, right? They might have a few during the reelection campaign. But I say that because just how much change under Donald Trump that we never even commented upon, right? But those mass rallies, which were, in my view, legitimately terrifying to watch, he loved them. That was the energy he liked. Some people get nervous in front of a crowd. Trump doesn't get, he doesn't care, right? It's the energy, it's the love they feel for him, it's all of that. That's really difficult to replicate. One, those are expensive. And if you don't have a campaign sending money in, you know, you can't pay for that. Two, why would you go to that to see the former president? It just, so he's going to have a hard time doing that. I also want to just say, I had a friend of mine who is a Democratic, retired, used to be a pretty big shot Democratic political consultant, but has a lot of contacts on the Republican side of the aisle. And he said a lot of Republican donors towards the end were getting upset because they give money to the RNC and they use it to buy copies of Donald Trump Jr.'s books, right? To then give out to other supporters and stuff, which is a grift. The fundraising will dry up. The structures will change. But I think it's optimistic to say Donald Trump will go away. Now, we have agency, right? I mean, I was asked on another show, should we be following Trump's tweets? And I said, no, go watch the new season of The Crown. I mean, go on live. You don't have to. It's no longer necessary as of January 20th to pay attention to him.
And there's a couple of things also, which is in a lot of ways, your story goes back to that New Yorkers knew Donald first and they spurned him before Americans. But what's so interesting is, even though he's now moved to Florida, he is going to be going back to New York, a New York courtroom. That's where he's going to go back to. And so between the attorney general and between Cy Vance, he's going to have legal fees coming out as you know what. His level of corruption, and this is before he got into the White House, everyone. So understand this is pre-2016. But as I said to you, Lincoln, when you came on the air, from the beginning, when Donald Trump came down that freaking escalator, when they were paying people $50 a shot to stand up there and applaud him, and I remember covering that immediately on the air, and I knew that escalator, one of the things that really upset me was that I kept saying, where were the Cy Vances and the attorney generals, and why did he get away? If it's not criminal, it's on the verge of criminal. And if it wasn't criminal, it was so civil, he would be bankrupt forever. What this shows you is about the double standard of justice. That's the problem. And that's where he becomes a poster child, not just for look what could move up the food chain and become our president, but it should be a message to every freaking prosecutor and attorney general. Don't you dare genuflect to wealth, because look what you do, because you have sent the message to me. We complain about Black Lives Matter. I'm wondering, why did Trump's life matter? And the only life that it mattered. And that's where I am unforgiving of all those people that are now going to be prosecuting him. We needed them a decade ago.
I think you raise a lot of good points. I would just interject one other thing before I respond to that, which is that I am not an attorney, much to my mother's ongoing disappointment. On the call with one.
I've never practiced, so it's okay. Your mother would be disappointed with me.
Yesterday, with a number of other people who work in politics, and one of the political people asked one of the attorneys, if he goes to Mar-a-Lago, which is where he's going to end up after the election, if he goes there, does Florida have to send him back to New York? And then one of the people on the call who had been a public defender and close with, you know, former governors and this kind of thing of his state said, no, it's the governor's discretion. Getting him back to a New York courtroom is not a given. The other thing I would say is that I remember when he first got into office, and your point about what happened in 2015 and how he should have been in jail before then is 100% right. But I want to raise two things. First, we spoke about Black Lives Matter. We alluded to Black Lives Matter, but this is why Black Lives Matter is so important.
Yes.
People like Donald Trump, I mean, Donald Trump gets to be president, but that's extreme. But even if he'd never been president, skated through, a career criminal, skated through with a life of wealth and comfort. And we know that if Donald Trump, with his personality, behavior, and conduct, had been born a low-income person of color, he would have spent his life bouncing between the criminal justice system, and just to be clear, I mean jail, and the mental health system. Yeah. That would have been Donald Trump's life. And that was not Donald Trump's life. But there's another point here as well. I was the national political correspondent for The Observer, which was owned by Jared Kushner. I didn't know this when I took the job, and I resigned mid-2016 for, let's just say, First Amendment-related issues. I was no longer comfortable writing there. But last piece I wrote, and I'm not sure it ever got published, I wrote this piece arguing that the reason Trump ran for president was strategy to stay out of jail. I think it goes back to that, even before he got in office. Early 2015, if you're Donald Trump and you're talking to, I guess Michael Cohen would have been his lawyer back then, And Michael Cohen, you know, I know Clarence Darrow, but presumably he knows a little bit about the law. And he's looking around and he's saying, you know, the circle is getting tighter. You're going to get in trouble. One strategy is to fight the legal battle and be hung up in court. At that point, he's in his early 70s, be hung up in court for decades because there were so many cases. There's tax evasion. There's real estate fraud. There's perjury. There's all kinds of
stuff. And it's not the attention he wants.
Right. Not the attention he wants.
Right. Exactly. I just want to go back to the idea that he craves attention.
But although it is better than nothing.
But not the attention he wants.
He would rather be on the front page of the Daily News because of his court case than not get any attention at all. But the legal strategy became raise your political profile. I don't know if this is true, but this is my view at the time. So that if you are prosecuted, it becomes a political prosecution.
Right.
That's incentive to do that. So this may have been part of the strategy, but it is absolutely true. The last point here is that the law firms that are, and some of them have left, that are representing Trump in these absurd legal challenges, right? And making a lot of money if Trump ever pays, which isn't a given. But we hear from the legal profession that everyone needs and has a right to defense, which in the abstract is true, but it's not how it works in America. See, people, primarily lower income people, primarily people of color, don't get the defense they need. Not because your public defenders aren't hardworking, decent, caring, compassionate, good lawyers, but because they're overworked. They're swamped, they're overworked, there's not enough funding and support for them. You can choose your clients, and you don't have to choose someone who is trying to steal an election and roll back American democracy. We all have those choices.
Well, but it's not even that. I've been a legislator, I've run for governor, I've run for Congress. I've been around a lot of Republicans and Democrats my whole life. And the one thing the Republicans kept talking about was that frivolous lawsuits, and they want to throw out those frivolous lawsuits. Not only do you not have to take it, it's a freaking frivolous lawsuit. I mean, just read what the judges are writing. I mean, you can almost see them rolling their eyes as they're writing this decision. Like, you are wasting my court time on this crap. And I want to remind everyone, isn't it ironic that the wealthy get to do frivolous lawsuits and Black Lives Matter and people who are, you know, low income or poor, they don't even get time in court. Or if they get a public defender, the public defender is so overworked, he has exactly 15 minutes to prepare for a case that might end them in jail for the next 45 years. Yesterday, we were talking about corruption, that Joe Biden really should address the corruption of the last 4 years. Right as I'm about to interview this person about this, Matt Ford from the New Republic, Joe Biden comes out and says, I don't want to look back. And I'm like ready to slap him around. And the reason I'm so angry at Joe Biden for saying that is that it's not just about Donald Trump. It isn't just looking back at him. It is really looking at the gestalt of failure of our attorney generals and our prosecutors to allow not just him, but there's a whole group of hims that need to be looked at. And Elizabeth Warren over and over again talked about corruption. I think people didn't understand how big a tent she was talking about. And Donald Trump is just one piece of that corruption. That's not looking back. That's about protecting us for the future.
Yes. And if you don't go after the corruption, you incentivize public officials, not just to be corrupt, but you incentivize corrupt people to go into public service so they can not be charged for corruption.
Right.
I mean, I remember when, to go back to Nixon, when Ford pardoned Nixon, that was I was a child, but that was at the time broadly seen as a good moving forward gesture. But I'm struck by the last several years when I talk to my students about Watergate, they're appalled that Nixon got pardoned because he got away with something. And there's some truth to that. The students are probably right, and the pundits 50 years ago were wrong. I would place this corruption issue, which, I mean, obviously the Trump presidency is an extraordinary moment of corruption, but corruption and white collar crime is a separate issue. But I would place this corruption issue in the broader issue of American democracy. One of the ideas that I had is that Biden should, now he's not going to be able to pass any legislation, I mean, meaningful legislation. So let's, you know, there was talk if the Democrats get enough seats in the Senate, they might expand the court. They might bring in Puerto Rico and DC for states. That's off the table for now. But you could, as president, instead, and the transitional justice question is complicated, right? Because if you prosecute these people, you are guaranteeing that you will be prosecuted even if you do nothing when you leave office. And this is something I've seen in other countries where I've worked too. So we've wrestled with it in those countries. But what you could do is set up an office, a cabinet level office, a White House level office, that is empowered to set up commissions and to bring in testimony about strengthening and reinvigorating American democracy.
Right.
Because this is part of that.
There is one thing that we know will happen is that the Trump administration has been refusing to provide documents to the House of Representatives. They are chomping at the bit for him to be gone because they really want to have sort of the whole
portfolio of crap that they have been denied. And you don't want them to spend all their time on that, but they won't, because they do have to worry about the pandemic and they do have to worry about the economy. Trust me, I have multitasked my entire life. They can multitask, but they also know what needs to sort of be displayed. And what will be interesting is if you got the Cy Vances and you got the Attorney General from New York doing her thing, if they refuse extradition, that never even freaking occurred to me. I'm thinking, oh my God, he didn't even have to go to Aruba. He didn't even have to go to Russia. All he had to do was go to Florida. Like, come on, that's ridiculous. But at the same time, I think then it becomes a parallel thing, so that not only are you speaking to the corruption that we want to protect in the future, but it also then speaks to Black Lives Matter and the division of the country, saying, we want equal justice. That's what this is about. It's about equal justice. And if you give Donald Trump a pass, then the term equal has been ripped from your mouth.
And Donald Trump's had a pass for more than 7 decades. That's a constant, not a variable here. The other thing, another way to look at this is that there are other ways to get at this question. So for example, we talk about the House, which is still in Democratic hands, getting this information. Now, there are laws about what you can shred in the White House as you're leaving. And the answer is you can't really shred anything, but or shred it on the computer in a virtual sense, whatever you prefer. They're going to still try to do that. But the other thing is that the House and the president and just ordinary civil society organizations, foundations, universities, media outlets can set up commissions, right? You could set up a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that has no government power, that is just civil university presidents, retired military people, retired politicians, civil rights leaders, clergy from different religious groups, and to take the testimony of what happened. Let's talk to some of those parents who crossed the border and had their family stripped away from them. Let's talk to the people in Portland who were running in the streets because unknown federal officers were trying to kidnap them. Let's talk to trans people. Let's, you know, all the people that were victims of the worst, you know, we're talking about domestic crimes, not to mention what I think is as a crime against humanity, right? Which is this mishandling of COVID, which is a crime, and mishandling is a crime against humanity. Most of the experts point to tens of thousands, if not more, of lives that would have been saved if we just done the basics. It was a crime against humanity. His friends got rich because of it. If we just take that testimony, at the very least, we can stigmatize these people, name names, get it all on paper. At least the historians will know. And then if the attorneys and the district attorneys here and the attorneys general in various states think it's worth prosecuting, you know, God bless them. But let's begin with that. To let this go and have nothing come of it is really a crime against any notion of justice.
What I keep hearing is that you're talking is the message that's being screamed at if we do hold these kinds of things is that I see you, I hear you. That's why people have disconnected from government, because they think that they only see certain people, but they don't see you. They only benefit certain people, but they don't benefit you. It is the example of, I too want to fight bad government. I too believe in good government. And when I see what my government has done on occasion, I am going to be the first outspoken person about that government sucks. That doesn't mean all government does. But I think that's one way you can sort of get to Joe Biden, because Joe Biden kind of ran not just on not being Trump, but the idea that he did have empathy and that he saw you, felt your pain in a way that wasn't Clinton-ish or even Barack Obama. It was real. If you are going to see me, then you have to hear my voice. I believe in all the senses. And one of the senses so important, obviously I believe in it because I use it all the time, is my mouth. If you allow people the opportunity to share their story, not only does it relieve them of that angst and that burden and that anxiety, but it also invites other people in to say, me too, me too. And I think that's how you create the Velcro once again, not only to believe in government, but to form what I think is important if we're going to go forward as a nation. We have to find connection. And isn't it interesting? Those things could actually offer us connection. They recognize that we matter.
And also, when you take Trump out of it, other people will listen. 40% of the country gets their back up and tunes out when you say anything critical of Trump. So if it's not about Trump, it's about here was what we experienced because of COVID. Here is what we experienced at the border. Now, there are obviously racial barriers that have to be overcome there, but they can. You know, democracy, which for me is a core kind of principle of my work, of my research, of my teaching, democracy doesn't work. I've seen the former Soviet Union, where I do a lot of work. Many people there, because of the experience of, you know, the Soviet experience, the post-Soviet authoritarian states in many of these countries, politics is something that happens over there in the Capitol. And the best thing I can do about it is keep my head down. You can't have democracy, a functional, deep, meaningful democracy, if that's how people think about it. That is how Donald Trump wants people to think about it, right? If your voice isn't heard and isn't heard and isn't heard, that is ultimately how you think about it.
One of the first interviews I did when Donald Trump got elected was based on a blog that turned into a book entitled On Tyranny by a professor from Yale. And I had read the blog before it became a book, and I was terrified. And then when I looked at the last 4 years, and literally Donald Trump checked off every single of his 20 lessons on tyranny. And I think the most important thing is that Donald Trump understood fear. And he used it not just on us, but he used it on his own Republican Party.
Oh, absolutely.
That's where I kind of look at my former GOP friends, and I'm looking at it and I'm saying, what does he take away from you? Your elected office that you earn a couple of $1,000s a year from, what can he really take away from you except your integrity and your sense of values and your sense of ethics? Because that's what he stripped you of. That's potentially permanent. This elected position is not permanent, but what he's doing to you potentially is. I have to let you go. Will you come back? Anyway, this was a fascinating conversation. Now you understand why I go to theconversation.com. The original reason we're having this conversation was based on a piece that Lincoln Mitchell wrote entitled New Yorkers Knew Donald Trump First, and they spurned him before many American voters did. We went everywhere, but so important at this point in time. Thank you so much for doing this.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. All right, everyone. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will be right back.
Insight Daily Radio.
From food to fashion, science to tech talk, or for just plain fun, we've got you covered. From the art of all things, here's Lasana Jeffries.
The Vikings who ruled Scandinavia in the Middle Ages believed that in the early days of the world, two tribes of gods roamed the earth. The Æsir, led by a god named Odin, were rough and tumble hunters and fighters. The Vanir were a gentler race who tended the soil and made it fertile. The loveliest of the Vanir was a goddess named Freya. Once the Æsir challenged the Vanir to battle, a truce was called, and the Vanir surrendered Freya as a hostage. Beautiful goddess kept peace between the two tribes. Freya was also known for looking after the souls of warriors who died in battle. Upon their death, she invited them to visit her grand hall in Asgard, the heavenly home of the Norse gods. Freya married a god named Odir, and they lived happily in Asgard until one day Odir mysteriously disappeared. Freya has been looking for him ever since. Riding through the night in a golden chariot drawn by two gray cats. Sometimes she dons a coat made of falcon feathers and flies like a bird, always searching for her lost love on moonless nights. Freya's sparkling necklace of gold, silver, and diamonds can be seen high in the sky. It's what we now call the Milky Way. Freya did not disappear. In Iceland, Freya was called upon for assistance by way of Icelandic magical staves as late as the 18th century. And as late as the 19th century, Freya is recorded as retaining elements of her role as a fertility goddess among rural Swedes. Thanks for listening. I'm Lisanna Jeffries.
Insight Daily Radio.
You have email.
Jamming.
Welcome back to part two of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. So I go to Vox.com a lot. There's now a section called Recode, and there was an article that sort of struck at my heart. Social media is making a bad political situation worse. Rani Mulla is joining us. She is the writer of this incredibly comprehensive and dense piece, a very important piece, Rani. So thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me here.
And as I was reading it, and my audience has heard me tell this story before, but I was terrified of social media and the internet from the beginning because it was too fast. It was instant gratification. Nobody took time to breathe. It was kind of like a whirling dervish, and it kept making us more and more intense. And I knew I really was afraid of it when I was going to my old radio station. I was doing a commercial show. I had replaced Rush Limbaugh on five stations. I just told the guy before me that. I was listening to this sort of talk therapist on the air. I think her name was Joy Brown. And so Joy Brown is on the air as I'm driving in. I've got my station on. I normally don't listen to Joy, but I'm listening. And there's a guy calling up about this incredible sexual, emotional relationship he's having with this woman online, right? And how it was just better than anything else. And the relationship was so amazing. And Joy's listening to him. And all of a sudden she says to him, "You're not having sex. You're not having a relationship. You're typing. Oh my God, you're typing. I almost drove off the road because in a lot of ways, that's the problem. Social media has replaced relationship. It has replaced conversation. It has replaced nuance. It has replaced breathing and giving yourself time. And then when you sort of layer it onto an incredibly divisive and political campaign, and we've been divided long before this. I'm a lefty Democrat who ran for governor in Congress, so I know about those sort of intense relationships. But we were already moving in that direction. This just sort of made it more hyper. And that's why your headline is so important, because it really does reflect what I have felt and seen. And so I want you to go through and sort of talk about the analysis, because you went to different places and different, you know, Pew, and you went to professors who really do the detailed work and the heavy lifting of actually saying, this is the result. This is the outcome. Don't be shocked by this. And that's good. So now, as you say, we have the inputs. Now what I want to know is, how do you put the genie back in the bottle? But that we will get to at the very
end. Sure.
Let's start by your article, because I found it fascinating and frankly, terrifying.
I'm glad you read it.
No, absolutely. And you, let me just begin with the first, your first sentence, which really I think helps us sort of kick this off. Mm-hmm. One, Eli, is it Pariser? Pariser?
Eli Pariser.
Eli Pariser.
I believe.
I'm a terrible name person. Coined the term filter bubble a decade ago. He narrowly defined it to be a situation in which algorithms skew the variety of information we get online in favor of stuff we like. At that time, he worried that might lead to political polarization through less exposure to divergent viewpoints. 10 years later, America is in the aftermath of a hyperpartisan presidential election in which people not only disagree with those on the other side. This is the operative language here. They actively hate them. Let's talk about what he saw moving forward and why, in some ways, he was almost limited in talking about it as a filter bubble, because it feels not like a bubble. It feels like a cell.
Right. Well, when he was first thinking about this, about a decade ago, and coined the term, you know, filter bubble, the idea was all of these algorithms were mediating what we see. If you go onto Facebook, you don't just see everything that's being posted, you see sort of what you want to see. You know, if you normally click on lefty Democrat links, you're going to see more of that. And I think he rightly pointed out that you're going to sort of create this bubble. You're going to create a bubble in which you only see things you sort of agree with. We are seeing a lot of things we agree with, but the reasons for it and the consequences of that are a lot more complicated. I, at the time, he thought, okay, you know, the solution to this is I just have to see the other viewpoint. I have to see if I'm looking for lefty news sites, I should also see Fox News. And one of the things we got to in the article was a study that Christopher Mims, actually from the Wall Street Journal, wrote about that shows that we actually are seeing other viewpoints on social media. It's just presented in such a way, and you know, we're seeing that. It makes things even worse. We're seeing the most acerbic of the opposing viewpoint. It's just sort of like confirms the idea that the other side is just horrible.
They present the other side, but they cherry pick. I used to teach mass communications, mm-hmm. and this is long before there was really social media. You know what I had my students do? I would take an AP story, and I would give them five newspapers of different political persuasions. Mm-hmm. And they had to take the same exact AP story and see how it was presented in the different papers. It
was fascinating.
Shocking to them. It was shocking to them. Because remember, the AP story is the content, not the headline. Right. So depending on whether it was a conservative paper or a liberal paper, the headline was completely different. It told you a completely different story than what you were about to read. This is where it got worse. It was where they placed it in the paper. Some people thought it was an important story, went on the front page. If it was like a conservative paper that didn't really want you to read it, or maybe they did, but for a different reason, they would put it on the obituary page. Okay? They would then rearrange the paragraphs in the AP story. So depending on what they wanted highlighted, because sometimes you don't get beyond the first paragraph, that was as far as you go. That was old, cranky manipulation.
Right. That's old.
Yeah, exactly. So if you're talking, I want people to know, yes, technically they could check the box. We covered that story. The problem is you and I could read it in those different venues and we would come away with a completely different understanding.
Right. And those are editorial judgments. And now you have on top of that sort of this like algorithmic judgment, which is just saying like, this is the thing we think you should see. Another issue here is that all of this is happening on social media. It's happening through text. We don't necessarily get the empathy that you and I might get talking to each other, seeing each other's face, seeing my reactions, sort of, you know, seeing the humanity of another person. It's really easy online and in social media to sort of divorce what someone's saying from the humanity of it. So it's actually a terrible, terrible place for these like polarized political discussions to be happening. You know, so that's why when you see someone on Facebook arguing with someone they went to high school with, it just doesn't usually get anywhere.
Your point about text. So that was actually one of the quotes that I pulled from your article and I put it up on Facebook. Huh. But here's why I did. I did because there are certain members of my family that only converse with me through text. That's it. Okay. They don't call me on the phone. They don't drop by. They text me. I hate it. I hate it. I know so little about their life. I know so little about what's really happening because the information they're providing, first of all, is so truncated. As you point out, there's no nuance. There's no empathy. There's no emotion. And in some ways, they think they're doing me a favor. I'm almost cringing whenever I get a text now because it's so not fulfilling. Right. It's so, in some ways, texts and tweets are emotionally draining because they so limit me
Absolutely.
To what I understand and what I know. And that I think is ironic because people think that there's a constant contact, but that constant contact feels almost like a pinprick and not like a hug.
Yeah, it's very surface layer. All of this conversation is sort of one of the points I was trying to get to in the article was that, you know, social media, I could go through the various studies, makes things worse. It makes these political arguments worse. It's actually the underlying stuff that we're coming to social media in the first place that's so messed up. It's a reinforcing system. You know, you have a very polarized America. As you mentioned, you know, people hate each other. I think people are less likely to marry or accept marriages from people in different parties. This didn't end up in the story, but one of the studies I looked at was actually a combination of studies that was written about in Science Magazine, discussed how divergent the two parties are. I think Republicans thought that like a third of Democrats are LGBT. And really it's, you know, it's like 6%, you know, like whatever the national average is. Democrats, meanwhile, thought that, you know, about a third of Republicans make over $250,000 a year. You know, really it's actually in the single digits. You know, so we just have a complete misunderstanding of the other parties. There's this measure of in-party love, you know, how you feel towards people in your own political party versus out-of-party hate. And in-party love has been like constant for the past, you know, however many years. But meanwhile, we feel a lot more hate towards the other party. So there's this like, for various reasons, usually having to do with like systemic inequality, probably, and just like, you know, the things that are difficult to change. We're coming to social media incredibly polarized. And then it's just like, you know, it's like shooting it off. It magnifies it once you're on social media for various reasons.
That was another one that I pulled out because of course I am a political player. I describe myself as a, you know, like a politician in recovery is how I refer to myself.
And again, let me just sort of reemphasize, because it's in this article. And again, you've got to go to Vox, you've got to go to Recode. Feelings of coldness toward the other party have emerged, a stronger force than warmth towards one own party. It's true. It's true. I am so critical of my party, you would not. But I am so pissed off at the Republicans in a way that I can't even comprehend them. But here's the difference. I come from a conservative family. I do. It's an English only on the frickin' door when I would walk in my house. Oops. My father had pictures of Newt Gingrich on the refrigerator. My daughter would come in and she'd see pictures of Ronald Reagan and she would go in, take a towel and cover the picture of Ronald Reagan. But I loved my father and mother. I would forgive them for their politics, but I could find a way to love them, okay? And that's important. I married a libertarian Republican atheist. People are like, oh my God, that's my second husband, not my first. Relationships mattered. I understood that I had to get beyond my knee-jerk response, which was to reject, to find out what I could love or what I could like or where communication could happen. And that's what's so terrifying about social media. In some ways, it doesn't even encourage even those of us that like each other as friends to have a relationship, because we think we're satisfied enough with what we have as our friendship on Facebook or our connection on Twitter. So in a lot of ways, it's not just hurting the partisan divide or the divide between races. It's actually hurting us in our ability to create real relationships with people that we probably would want to love and would want to have dinner with.
Right. I always think it's funny. Facebook's mission statement is, you know, bringing the world closer together. And, you know, in a lot of ways, it's pushing them further apart. There was one University of Virginia study in there. I think they found they associated increased use of social media with reading more polarized content. This was especially true for Republicans. If they happened to have spent more time on social media, then they ended up on more extremist websites. There's other studies out there that says that most people kind of read generally the same stuff. It's unclear, you know, whether the news fault, but there is definitely extremists on either side. But I wanted to point to a Pew Research seems to say that we're reading more and more polarized content, especially Republicans are. They say they trust a lot of mainstream news a lot less, which makes a lot of sense if, you know, if our president has been saying, you know, not to trust the media, and getting more and more of their information from right-wing sources and from Fox News. The other part of that is that we're also getting a lot more just news in general from social media.
From Facebook. Oh, no, there's no question. You know, it's really interesting. So I'm watching the governor of Iowa, who basically said that, you know, wearing a mask was just so ridiculous. And now all of a sudden, everyone's dying in Iowa. And all of a sudden, she's like mandating a mask mandate. I want to give her a knuckle sandwich. And now we're hearing all the stories about the vaccines coming out. The rollout is going to be the challenge. It's not that we have a vaccine, it's whether you get a vaccine. That's a completely different conversation. I wanted a billboard in North Dakota, South Dakota, Oklahoma, Iowa, across all those places. And I wanted to say, you know what a vaccine is? It is a celebration of science and public health. You know what a vaccine is? It is the success of science in huge letters and public health. You better protect science and thank a healthcare worker. And I wanted there, I want to use the word science and vaccine, because they have been trashing not just the media, but they've been trashing science. Look what may save your life in places that have been in denial and thinking that it was an East Coast problem. And now it's going to be, how many people can I bury in a day in places like North Dakota? Again, the social media has reinforced it. My question is, how do I avert their eyes from social media? Now you know why I like billboards, because you can't avert your eyes. You're eventually going to be driving down a road. I have been praising billboards since I ran for office. I believe in them because in a way, it's the only way for me to hopscotch over people's glued to their social media, because when they drive, technically they're supposed to be looking at the road. Well, then I want them to see my billboard.
That makes me think of another part of the Pew study. It said, you know, there's an increased percentage of people getting most of their news from, or a lot of their news from social media. You know, that's one thing, but also those people tended to be less informed about current events and more likely to be exposed to conspiracy theories, including that, you know, coronavirus is fake or, you know, masks don't work and that sort of thing. So it actually is contributing to the sort of public health crisis.
So what is our solution? And I kind of want to get to that. But in a way, what is old is new again. What is old is new again. That's why I go back to billboards and people think I'm crazy. I remember the BurmaShave ads. You know what the BurmaShave ads were? You know what
they were?
Oh, let me teach you. I had a state rep who was new to the community who wanted to run for state rep, but she didn't know how to introduce herself, especially at a time like this where we're so challenged.
I said, well, you should do Burma Shave ads. And she's going, what are you talking about? And I said, Burma Shave ads are ads where there's a billboard and then another billboard and then another billboard and they're close together and they tell a story. So as
I think I've seen those.
You've seen those. So here's what she did. She put her name on the first billboard and then she wrote attorney, farmer, mother, organic. She went through all these things of describing her. And then the last billboard said exhausted. She won. She won because everybody liked her. They saw how incredibly dense her portfolio was because she did it with one word. Mm-hmm. But at the end, she also sort of reminded them she's humble too, that this is multitasking that's really hard, but it's what we do. And therefore, people could relate to what we do. And I really do think that what is old is new again. And it's not just billboards, is that I believe now we have to look at universal service. I need to put different people together in a room working with each other, where it isn't social media that's bringing them together. It's a requirement that they have to do something arm in arm, shoulder to shoulder. And that may be the only answer, Rainey.
Right, but that's also a lot harder to do when we're not allowed to be arm in arm and shoulder in shoulder. Like that's another one of those extenuating circumstances.
Right, but this is a temporary.
Right. You're right.
If we look at it as permanent, then we are exhausted and we come up with no solutions. But in a funny way, this is how we look at life after the pandemic. But life after the pandemic isn't just about how we fix healthcare. It's how we fix our heads. When you wrote about what to do about it, who else did you talk to?
For the solutions to this, like, you know, they're so open-ended, but I actually came back to Eli Pariser, the internet activist who coined the term filter bubble in the first place. And he's actually been working, he founded moveon.org, but he's actually been working on creating a social media now that actively encourages discussion in a way that's effective. Basically, he's saying that on social media now, the conversations we have are completely not ineffective. He's trying to create a sort of a public forum that works. And the thing is, that takes a lot of investment. That takes actually moderating a conversation, making sure that you and I aren't just yelling at each other, aren't just like one-upping each other. You need like human facilitators, almost like if you were in therapy and you know, you need someone to sort of who's educated in this to be able to foster these good conversations. That's one part of it. He also discussed, you know, just more investment in our public institutions. And these are giant problems to fix. It's not like we could just slap a Band-Aid on it or slap a warning label on a tweet. It's a matter of fixing public schools, libraries, you know, making sure that we're aware of how to read the news and understand what fake news is in the first place. And then there's also this idea of just intense inequality that's sort of maybe contributing to in the first place to why we're so polarized, why we're so upset, why we can't talk to each other. So like, I don't think there's many easy answers to this. It's like social media is part of the problem and that you were wanting it to also be the solution, but it's like, it's not the end or the beginning of any of those.
Well, you know, it's so interesting that you mentioned that he wants to go back to social media for the solution. Come on, you know who's going to show up at those discussions are going to be people that are already motivated to show up for those discussions. It's not those people. It's the 70 million that voted for Donald Trump, of which probably 62 million of them would never show up in one of Eli's, like, you know, groups or conversations or informed with discussions. One, they don't have the time, okay? They don't see the benefit because, let's be honest, most people do a cost-benefit analysis. What do I get out of this? And for a lot of people, do they get to pay their rent out of this? No. Do they get to pay their food bill out of this? No. This is how desperate they are for both time and for opportunity. This is going to sound interesting, but I would love to talk to him because I remember being at Harvard when I was a fellow at the Kennedy School. They had this big international, 1997, they had a big international conversation with women from around Europe coming in and then women from around the United States. And here was the question that was asked. Listen to this. What would you like more of? Would you like more time or more money? Let me tell you what the answer was. The answer from the European women was they wanted more time. The answer from the American women was they wanted more money. But do you know why they wanted more money? Because they don't have free healthcare, because they don't have free daycare, because they didn't have free college education, where in most European countries, there was universal healthcare. In most European countries, they didn't have to worry about going into debt if their kid wanted to go to college. In most European countries, they had 6 to 8 weeks of, you know, vacation time, paid vacation time. And I remember because people were so angry at the American women because they sounded so greedy because they wanted more money than time. And I remember standing up in front of them and scolding them and saying, don't you understand what these women in Europe have that we don't have is they have a social safety net that lets them want time with family, that gives them time with friends. What we have done is denied us that opportunity. And I'll be honest with you, social media has made that worse too.
Right. Just the sheer amount of time we spend on that. Like, and it's obviously not fixing the monetary problems there either.
Your piece was so intriguing because it got me off on so many different places where if we think social media is part of the solution, I think we're wrong. It's not that social media can't exist. It has to be one finger on the hand. And too often than not now, it's become the whole hand. And we've refused to look at what is sort of outside of it. And then I will leave you with one last point. Republicans have very interesting, and I've been doing this for a long time, have very interesting solutions to life. To condense it, it's no government, no taxes, no health care. The idea that you're on your own, Jack, all right? And so their answer for a lot of things is the word no. And I'm really jealous of the word no. You know why? Because it's perfect for social media. Because it's short. It doesn't need to be explained. It doesn't have nuance. When you say the word no, you end the conversation. Now, my side is about yes. Yes, some government. Yes, some taxes. Yes, healthcare. Yes, education. But guess what? The yes doesn't fit on a Twitter. It doesn't fit on a Facebook page. It takes time to explain. It takes pages. It takes patience. Unfortunately, I think what we didn't also realize is that social media aided and abetted the no's and undermined the yes. Because yes is about time. And we haven't given people time anymore. And that's why your piece was so depressing and important. And I'm just hoping that as we have the conversation after we get through this pandemic and we actually survive, that we figure out how we bring people together and not just through my computer and not just through Zoom. I hope that when you write these pieces again, ask people about the human component, because most of what you wrote about sort of use social media as I felt like I was in some ways on a, I was on a leash, and my leash only allowed me to look at social media. Mm-hmm. And I think somehow we need to figure out how we get off that leash. That makes sense.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for writing for Vox. I want to make sure that everyone goes to my Facebook page and the Attitudes Facebook page. They will find your content there with me, and you will also find a link to your article. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, everyone. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. You better-